Well, welcome everyone to Tribal Gatherings. My name is Mark Ingram, and my guest today is Maruti Sakamuri, who did his PhD in tribology and has more recently moved into investment banking. He's an investment risk analyst with USIM. Welcome, Maruti. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing fine, Mark. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Okay, so you have quite an interesting journey as you did some fantastic work in your PhD. And have gone into the City of London now. So I thought we'd take your journey through. So how did you get into tribology?
So I think it first started with my master's project. So I was always interested in research. So in my bachelor's, I did my bachelor's in Dubai in mechanical engineering. And we built this Formula student team, me and like a few others. And that's how we sort of got very interested into research and got sort of pulled into research. And then when I joined the University of Southampton as a master's student in mechatronics, I had to look at different options and projects that were on the list. And one of them was this project with Shell and looking at lubricants, aging them, trying to see how sensors pick up the oil degradation and all of that. And this was supervised by my current supervisor. And that's how I got into tribology. I built this custom oil degradation rig degrading oil systematically, running it through different sensors, mostly a tan delta sensor that measures tan delta, and also a viscosity sensor by Parker Hannifin. And it all sort of comes together to give a solid understanding of what's happening to the oil when you try and degrade it. In our case, we degraded it by heating the oil to very high temperatures. So that was my first stint in tribology. And once I finished my master's, I just wanted to continue because I liked this problem-solving approach. And in tribology, I think, you're very aware, we do have problems that need answers, but not many people out there, nobody out there really knows what the answer is. So I like that little aspect of it, and that's why I wanted to continue in tribology and then went on to do the PhD.
Fantastic. Now, in terms of your oil degradation work, sounds really, really interesting. So you, was it for anyone in particular, or what type of oils were you degrading? What was the kind of motivation?
So it was for Shell, and Shell wanted to test this new sensor on the market, a tan delta sensor, and we also used some other reference sensors to see how it performs. And what the tan delta sensors does is it measures permittivity, and among other, and also tan delta, they have a special formula as to how tan delta is measured. And what the idea, at least what I found from my research, is quite useful in measuring degradation of fully additized oils. Very few sensors out there give you like stages in oil degradation. Like, for example, in fully additized oils, when you start heating them up, they first go through an additive depletion, and then later on go on to have oxidation. And this trend of additive depletion and then later on oxidation is seen quite well when using a tan delta sensor. The tan delta usually tends to drop and then later on increase when the polar constituents in the oil increase in number.
In terms of the viscosity of the oil during the aging, what does that profile look like in your test rig?
The viscosity, when you heat the oil, obviously the viscosity drops at that particular point in time, but overall I do not exactly remember what happened to the viscosity. But you'd believe that it does go up with the addition of polar constituents in the oil.
Yeah, fair play. In terms of it's a very interesting project because there's more and more kind of standardized tests now for oils, which which need aged oil, you know, because a lot of the tests that are done, well, the mechanical tests that are done on oil before they're released to the field, they're done on fresh oils, obviously, but you know that state of the oil doesn't last for very long. so I think the kind of work you did there is probably very important, you know. And well, not obviously the Tan Delta sensors is a big innovation, but the kind of overall work as well is still important.
Yeah, I think the main sort of idea of the project was to have interchangeable sensors. So tomorrow, let's say there's a new sensor on the market that requires testing, it's sort of like plug and play. All it needs to do is fit into the recirculating system, and then you can run the same test over again. And then if it was connected to the tribometer at the University of Southampton, so you can actually run wear tests to produce you know, like debris for it to sort of feed into the oil recirculating system and so on. So it's all like a big system. But in my case, I didn't have much time. So all I did was use the tribometer to heat the oil, but not really run a wear test.
I get you. Yeah, you only had a year, I suppose. So well done.
Yeah, it was, I think it was more like 6 months for the MSc project. But yeah.
Well, wow. And then so, how did you start your PhD then? How did you, you know, how did that come about?
So after the after my master's, I could say that my master's project was decently successful. So my PhD supervisor did ask me to sort of come back and do a PhD. And I was quite interested in doing a PhD as well, because I was very fascinated by research and like problem solving and all those aspects. So I went back to my supervisor, did ask him if he has a PhD position open, and he said yes, and he does have a grant coming in from Schaeffler in Germany, which is, when it started at least, was way in line with what I did in the master's project, which is like playing with a lot of sensors. But over time, it sort of morphed into something different. So yes, and that's when I started my PhD, and that's the story so far.
Yeah, no, great. In terms of so your PhD then was in, well, I've only had seen one of your papers. It's in the running in of surfaces. Was that the broad kind of aim, was to study the running in, or what was the kind of broad aim of the PhD?
The broad aim, at least when it started, so this came directly from Schaeffler, and they wanted to understand how surfaces change during the running in stage and probably build a model that they can use to sort of predict what the surface changes during the running in stage are. So this was the task that was given to me. But I think they assumed at the start to be a scientific model, something like a scientific model, but I sort of turned it into a bit more experimental and fed that experimental data into a machine learning model to give them sort of like an experimental machine learning model, if I can say that. So, but that was the idea. Obviously, you know, when you look at running in and looking at surface changes, there's very little research out there. It's very niche field. It's quite important, but it's also a very niche field. So there's very little research out there. So when I started this, I was like, I need to understand how the surfaces actually change and then build on from there.
You're right. You do. Running in is completely key, and I think it's overlooked a lot. And a lot of the work, you know, I've been involved in over the years, it's, you know, if we're developing some kind of mechanical test for a lubricant, it's always boring to think about the running in. You know, it's, you just, right, it's the first 30 minutes of the test or whatever, and you just ramp a few things and then you get going, but I think your work showed it's quite key, isn't it, to understand that, especially, well, not so much from your point of view, it's for longevity of bearings, I suppose, and feeding into your model. And that's why I think your work is so important. Is you're right, it's completely neglected and not many people do it. And thank you for all that amazing research.
I think there are lots of I think I showed like way a bit, just a little sort of teaser of what it looks like, but I think there's a lot more in-depth research required to understand what's it like. So at the moment, we probably know how the surface changes during running in, but there's still a lot of unanswered questions, right? We still do not know what running in procedure should we put a bearing through so it lasts much longer. We do not know which is ideal running in, which is non-ideal running in, and there hasn't been much research into that either. Does one running in, maybe let's say we run it at high speeds, so like high pressures, does that sort of benefit a longer duration of a bearing, or does it sort of diminish its life? Nobody knows. So, and again, I think it's all stepping stones. Somebody will have to take on this research. And again, the stuff that I did was purely with base oil. So again, once you add an additive, or once you use additized oil, I think it completely changes the whole dynamic again. So there are lots of levels to this problem. And I think there's if somebody really wants to look into this, there's a lot to look into.
Yes, I completely agree. I think, you know, adding the kind of dimension of different additives to your research would be a fantastic next step. Is someone carrying on that work in Southampton, do you know?
No, not really. I think the running in research is quite niche, right? So the stuff that I did was only possible with you, to be very honest. I think the use of MTM was key to understanding what happens to the surface. So as you've probably read from my paper, I used this special relocation method to go back to the same spot on the disc surface before and after running in. It took quite some time to perfect the method. In my case, I used these little micro hardness indents outside the wear patch and sort of got my way around, like trying the same point on the surface before and after running in. And that bit, I could only finding the exact same patch was only possible on an MTM disc because of its flat nature. I've been after testing on the MTM, I did a bunch of tests on a twin disc tribometer, and it's a lot tougher trying to find the same spot on a twin disc tribometer.
I see, because you just have a line to look down from the microscope. Is it what makes it harder on the twin disc?
So first I'll explain what I did with the MTM disc, and then I can sort of build from there. So the MTM discs, I sort of knew where the wear patch on the MTM disc was before sending it to you. So I sort of scanned that little area on the wear patch and put a little micro indent point outside the wear patch as well, so I can relocate exactly the same point. And I sent it off to you. You do the test and you send it back to me, and then I go back to the same spot and try and finding it. So this firstly was quite easy to do because of these micro indent points. And once you have a circular twin disc sample, firstly, your optical profilometry doesn't work too well because it's curved in nature. So you have only some parts of the surface that are lightened up. And then once you try and, like, even putting it into an SEM is a huge stretch. But once you try and put it into an SEM, I think again the curvature of the disc sort of affects that too. So there's a lot more. It's a slightly more difficult challenge, I'd say, trying to find the same spot on a twin disc tribometer disc. But with the MTM it worked exceptionally well. So if somebody out there has an MTM that they can run multiple tests on, they can do lots of relocation stuff and find out exactly what's happening to these surfaces. And I think it'll get completely new insights into what's exactly happening to the surface, I think, which is sort of lacking in tribology, I think.
Yeah, no, just like a very in-depth look at a very certain point on the sample. I agree.
Exactly, yeah. Like, I think most tests that we do in the lab, we only measure roughness, maybe inside the contact patch, outside the contact patch, average it, you know, and we show that this is what the roughness is like. I think it works quite well for heavy duty tests or crude tests or like wear tests. But if you want to measure something that is as delicate and as sensitive as running in, I think going back to the same spot is key. And the MTM disc allows for that quite well.
Yes. It reminds me of, I think you reference it in your paper, is it Alistair Clark at Cardiff did some very nice work with a 2D profilometer. I think it's for micro pitting, wasn't it? Where he followed the asperities at the, you know, the highest asperities, and he could prove that those then would become micro pits. And another one was Kuba Jakub Jelita Rydel is his full name, and he used an AFM, you know, a bit more in depth, but his relocation method, the way he did it was, I think, similar with kind of four indents or maybe three indents, and then making it, but because it was his main challenge was because it's the film thicknesses were so small, and he wanted to measure that film thickness very accurately. It's things like leveling the surface digitally, and you know, the twist and the, you know, the different ways of leveling it was one of the innovations he kind of worked on. That was some lovely work. But yeah, I completely agree. Is the relocation stuff. Did you see the work by I think it's Greg Sawyer's group who advocate using Lego, the toy, because it repositions samples very
very accurately.
Yeah, it does. Yes.
Well, okay. Yeah. No, I haven't looked into that. But like when you talk about leveling the surface, I think that was one very key challenge, right? Because even in Alistair Clark's research, you have these 2D profilometers, and in my research, I show optical profilometry. And you have these surfaces, even with relocation, you're looking at the same surface before and after, but you do not know exactly what the level is, because I think in Alistair Clark's research, he assumes that the valleys remain unchanged and they sort of match it with the valleys. But are we entirely sure that the valleys change is the question. So in my research using the SCM, I managed to find that the valleys do change due to plastic deformation. So the whole sort of, it opens up a whole can of worms. You know, what do we do? How do we do profilometry if each and every point on the surface is prone to changing? How do we level the entire place?
Oh, I see. Yeah, it's a difficult problem. In terms of, I think some of the findings, you know, that I think this is correct. You found that the plastically deformed, the asperities of the surface plastically deformed, and you had like flat planes formed on the top. Is that correct?
Yes. So what we found is that peaks usually tend to sort of flow into the valleys. So you do see a reduction in peak height, some of it due to wear, but some of it due to plastic deformation as well. And that sort of plastically deforms into these valleys. And then you have a reduction in roughness. So before my research, the reduction in roughness due to running in was attributed to only a reduction in peak height due to wear, or maybe a bit of plastic deformation. But in reality, it's a bit of a reduction in peak height and also reduction in valley depth due to the material sort of flowing into the valleys. So it's a twofold sort of reduction in both directions.
In terms of how do you think the bear manufacturers will use your results in, is it possible to use this kind of knowledge in the design or finish of the bearings? How do you think Schaeffler will use it?
I think for Schaeffler to use this research, so the way Schaeffler are hoping to use my research is to try and predict what the roughness of a surface might look like after running in, and then using that roughness data after running in, they try and compute friction during steady state, which sort of gives an indication to them as to how long a bearing might last. They have models that are ready that sort of input friction, steady state friction, and estimate exactly how long bearings might last. So that is one way they're hoping to use. But in terms of understanding of running in and using it for running in procedures, I think we're still a few steps away from that. I think a bit more research is required as to what running in procedure is good for a bearing.
There's one thought I had was in terms of the finishing of the bearing, obviously you go down to polish the raceways, but the running in will itself reduce roughness in certain ways. I wonder if there's like an interplay in a way to save money there. If they can reduce an operation in the manufacture of the bearing, is that something do you think they're looking at, or what's your thoughts?
Like pre-running bearings before sending it out to them?
Well, almost like the other way. Like you'd miss, if you're confident that the bearing will be used in a certain way, the roughness will be reduced to the manufacturer's benefit, they could remove a step in the production. So, they might not use the last polishing stage because during the manufacturing, the polishing, it's like each step costs more and more money and you use the diminishing returns. So, they can stop at an earlier step. Do you think that's something that they could benefit from?
So in my understanding of running in, I like even the smoothest of the surfaces, if run in mildly, which is just a bit of contact before they achieve steady state, is they reduce in roughness. So I don't think there's any money in like skipping a step of polishing. I think there's sufficient evidence out there that shows that the smoothest surfaces always perform the longest. But I think I think it'll sort of help, like any sort of running in research in the future, at least help the purchaser of the bearings or like give them some insight as to how to run in a bearing and how to make it sort of last longer, if that's even a possibility in the future. So.
In terms of so do you have any more papers coming out, or what's the plan now?
So that was my MTM paper. So I'm at the moment I'm working on my twin disc tribometer results. So I ran a bunch of twin disc tribometer tests, but in this case, sort of varied pressure, speed, and slip ratio, and sort of ran like a parametric sort of test, but also at like different points in speeds, just to see how the surface changes with different running in regimes. But I'm still consolidating all that data, and hopefully I'll have a paper in the future that sort of showcases those results, and maybe it'll be a nice continuation to the MTM research that we did. And then again, once I have that data, I'll be modeling it using machine learning, and that would be used by Schaeffler to sort of predict what the surface of a bearing would look like after running in.
Okay, to talk me through your machine learning model then. What are the kind of inputs, and what are your kind of predictors for your model?
So the inputs are your operating conditions. In this case, we assume that the oil is a base oil and there are no chemical interactions in the oil. But in my case, the inputs are your operating conditions, your pressure, then your speed, your slip ratio, and then followed by the input roughnesses of both the surfaces. And the output is the roughnesses of both the surfaces again. So it sort of tells us, in my case, I ran each test for 100,000 cycles, assuming that all these tests sort of finish running in by then, and give me what the surface of the bearing would look like after 100,000 cycles or after running in. And this is what the model would predict. It'll tell us exactly what the roughness of both the surfaces would look like after running in. And you can obviously vary the input roughnesses, your operating conditions within the envelope that the machine learning model is trained on.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. In terms of how many tests do you need to do? How much physical data do you need to train the model?
So I performed 26 tests on the twin disc tribometer, To be honest, a lot more than 26 tests, but out of like problems, as you know, with experimental tests, you do end up with a few problems here and there. So I managed to get 26 sets of usable data. And then so I sort of split it into two for each disk separately. This is known as feature engineering in machine learning, to sort of increase the number of data points in the row-wise and reduce it in the column-wise. And that sort of helped me predict the roughness a bit more accurately. So in total, I ran around 26 tests, but ended up with around 52 data points.
Okay, yeah. It's always the problem, Aruti, isn't it? When we try and build models in, you know, experimental tribology, it's we have very little data to go on, so it's always a difficult thing. There's one test we're doing you might be interested in at the moment is so we're going to 30 or 50 million contact cycles on the MTM rig, so I think it's 17 days long. You know, so if I remember correctly, some of your tests were 1 second.
1 second. Yeah. Those were the interval tests.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other end of the scale then, and this is looking at, we measure roughness as well, but we're looking at, you know, tribofilms over that extended period of time. You know, how they, it's similar kind of science to you, but on a longer scale. That the most people just look at the tribofilms building up over the first couple of hours. And then get bored and turn the test off. But, you know, the machine in use will actually, that tribofilm will experience a lot of cycles. And what happens to that tribofilm then? So we're looking at that. And so we measure it up to 30 million contact cycles with the MTM Slim and probably some SEM and other kind of analysis techniques. And it's really interesting, actually, what I do. There's a clear kind of reduction for most of the oils after, you know, a certain period. I forget what the number is now, probably about 1 million contact cycles. Most of them start losing their tribofilm. The tribofilm starts reducing.
Is this research published?
Yes, I think we're publishing it at SGLE next okay. year. Hopefully it'll be a next paper.
That does sound quite interesting. I've had a few papers that looked into the Slim system on the MTM. You can clearly see what the tribofilm looks like. I think it's definitely an excellent bit of kit that you have at Ingram Tribology. And if I do sort of venture down in oil tribology again, you know, that would be something that I look forward to.
Yeah, what do we need to do to get you back, Maruti? Well, I suppose on that note, yeah, how did you, I hate to ask this question, but how did you get out of tribology?
I've been doing engineering for quite some time. I started uni when I was 17. So I've been in this field for a really long time. And I think the PhD I reached that, scale, I'd say. You know, I think the learning curve stopped becoming a bit steeper. So I thought, I always sort of appreciate the steep learning curve, something like that interests me, and that's something I can learn. And that's when I sort of was like, you know what, maybe I should take a little break from engineering, sort of move into something different, something with another steeper learning curve I can sort of hone my skills in, and then maybe come back to this in the future. But that's for a future, for some other time, I guess.
So it's like a new challenge beckoned. But are you still writing up? Have you written up your thesis?
Yes, I'm writing up at the moment, and also doing a few data modifications in my machine learning data set. So okay. It's going hand in hand.
So when did you start your new job, and how did you get into finance? Talk us through how that happened.
So like, I think I've always been this person that has, you know, toes dipped in like multiple sort of ponds, I'd say. And this was back during COVID time, you know, and I sort of got interested in markets, in trading and so on. Like many people out there, I guess, and that sort of spiked my interest, and it was a nice learning curve, learned a bit about it, and sort of ventured down into a bit of a rabbit hole, got used to like different sort of financial instruments, like, you know, futures, options, pick those, all those, and it's very simple mathematics, and it's very anybody from engineering can easily pick it up, I guess, and that sort of got me down this path. And last year, you know, when the PhD was getting a bit tiresome, I was like, maybe I should sort of try and find something new, something that I can start, you know, looking forward to again, something that excites me. And I sort of applied to different places for a summer internship, and managed to land a summer internship at my current firm, which is USS Investment Management. And then after the internship, I was offered a full-time role at the same firm, and I just started last week as a full-time investment risk analyst.
Oh, congratulations, Maruti! How's it going? Are you enjoying it, or what?
Yes, I absolutely love what we do here. So I think you know, usually when you tell people that you sort of moved into finance, they sort of look at it as a devil's work. Especially you know, that's the opinion of many engineers or like many sort of researchers out there. But I think that's why I ended up choosing a pension fund rather than a bank or a hedge fund. You know, in our case, we manage pension money of university employees in the UK. We're the largest private pension fund in the UK, and we at USS Investment Management sort of manage it all, and we're non-profit. And I think that sort of helps me sleep a bit better at night. Again, what we do here is super exciting. I work in risk, and so sort of protect the scheme and protect like desks from market risk scenarios, which is very interesting, keeps you on the toes. And and I'm pretty sure anybody with an engineering background could do it very well.
It's, well, you know, the reason we wanted to kind of get you on was a lot of engineers go this way, don't they, into finance. And I didn't know the USS was not for profit, actually, so that's really interesting.
So every bit of profit that we make sort of goes back into the scheme, so it gets redistributed to the pensioners. So at the moment, we've performed quite well last year, and we are plus 7 billion as in compared to our liabilities, which means that, which is excellent for the scheme members. It sort of goes back, and in the future, there's a potential chance of contributions coming down and so on. So, we are completely non-profit that way.
I'm sure, like, you know, lots of academics, I think all academics have a pension with this scheme, won't they? I think you have to. Well, I'm not sure if you have to, but it's silly not to.
Yes, I think it's an excellent scheme in terms of we hold large amounts of something known as a DB fund. That means it gives guaranteed pay when you sort of retire at like a very steady amount, and the risk is not really on the people paying into the scheme, but rather the risk is on you know, USS or the universities. So I think, you know, it's an excellent scheme to sort of sign up to. I think and even the contributions from the employer are quite large. So, and that's how we make up the biggest scheme in the UK. So it's an excellent place to invest, I'd say. And I have, so as I'm an employee at USIM, I get to put my money into USS as well. And it's a no-brainer at this point.
Yeah, I have a small, so I did 2 years at Imperial College as a researcher. So I have a very small fund at USS. Actually, I should probably need to update it all. Reminds me. But I think a lot of academics, if they're listening, would probably be very happy that someone as sensible as yourself is working there, and someone with a knowledge of tribology. So they might sleep better at night knowing their money's been well taken care of.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent firm. I think the people are usually, you know, when you sort of, I've been exposed to a lot of finance places, banks, hedge funds, and I believe that USIM, you know, we have the best culture out there. The people are exceptionally nice, and they have this proper desire to actually, you know, they safeguard the money, and they have actual desire, you know, to like protect the scheme from all these risks, at least in the investment risk analytics team. So it's a very sort of it's a very good culture, and it sort of goes it sort of revolves around protecting you know, pension money, which is quite key, I'd say.
What advice would you have for other engineers, not, I suppose, not just tribologists, but yeah, say a tribology person doing a PhD now who may be thinking about going to London and joining into finance? What kind of advice would you have for those people now?
I think engineering sort of gives you these like broad range of skills, right? I think in my case, the skills that I use at USIM is mostly my Python skills. So anybody out there with a bit of machine learning and a bit of Python, like a bit of mathematics skills, can easily sort of cross apply their skills to like a finance sort of setting. And I think those are the skills that maybe a tribologist should sort of pick up or look to pick up, you know, if they haven't already. So, and obviously, we don't really use tribology at the firm, but I'd say, you know, Python especially is quite key, and it's in very high demand at the moment, especially in financial services.
One of our stock questions, I know you don't work in tribology now, but one of the questions we ask is, you know, so what? This comes from Radio 4, so it's like a vehicle desert island disc where you have to choose your, you know, five records that you're marooned on a desert island and you only have five records to listen to for the rest of your days. This one is you're marooned on a desert island, but this desert island has a tribology lab. So I'm going to give you a viscometer. I'm going to give you some, what else would you find useful? I'm going to give you a grinding polishing machine so you can make your samples with different references, and the Southampton tribology notes and a few textbooks, and you get to choose one tribometer or one piece of equipment to do your research on while you're waiting to be rescued. so which piece of lab equipment would you like to take?
I think definitely the MTM. I think they're multiple. So you can obviously reuse the, I don't think PCS instruments would really like this answer, but you can probably reuse the samples, grind them again, and then keep using them over and over again. I think the MTM would be quite nice in terms of the... It's quite small, so you can carry around on the island, I guess. But also in terms of the testing that you can do, it's quite varied. Lots of different pressures, lots of different speeds that you can test them on. And I think it would definitely be the MTM just because how robust it is. We have many machines out there, like tribometers out there, you know, that are quite heavy, that sort of give very crude results, that sort of break quite often. But I think if you can, I'm not sure if I can say this, but if you can sort of say, you know, there's an Apple or iPhone out there, I think that would be the MTM. It just works very well, and very consistent results as well.
Yes, yeah, and you used it to great effect in your research, and you're so very well done. I suppose we'll start wrapping it up. Do you have anything you'd like to kind of plug or say before we kind of sign off?
No. You know, if anybody out there, you know, is looking forward, is sort of interested in my research, please feel to reach out to me. I'm on LinkedIn, or you can also probably send me a, you can probably, if you're from Southampton, you can find my email address on the Southampton server, so you can always reach out to me that way. But yeah, I'm happy to help in any, if somebody is looking to sort of switch into finance, I can sort of guide them the right way, I guess, using my limited experience. But any questions or regarding my research or in life in general, please do send a message or an email.
Oh, thank you, Maruti. That's great. I'll post a link to your, I think you have, yeah, your LinkedIn and some of your other associate, if you have access to the ResearchGate, I think your research is on there, and I'll post those in the comments. Thank you so much for joining me, Maruti, and it's a pleasure to work with you briefly, and fingers crossed one day you'll come back, but keep doing an amazing job in the USS and keep all our academics in good with good pot of money for their retirement.
Yeah, I've been explicitly told by many academics at Southampton to protect their pensions.
Oh, well done. Well, thank you very much, and thanks for listening, everybody, and catch you all soon. All right, cheerio. Bye-bye.